City. This is Louis A. DeCaro Jr., and this is John Brown Today. In 1910, Oswald Garrison Villard, a white philanthropist, editor, and civil rights activist, won broad acclaim for his new biography of John Brown, which marked a full half century since the abolitionist's execution on a Virginia gallows in 1859. What made this work even more interesting was that Villard was the grandson of William Lloyd Garrison, a gigantic figure in the history of abolition. Garrison, who was a contemporary of John Brown, was an anti-slavery orator and publisher. Besides defeating the older colonization ideology, which appealed to many whites, both pro-slavery and anti-slavery, because it presented the alleged solution of deporting black people, Garrison became the most important voice in abolition, perhaps until the rise of Frederick Douglass, whom Garrison himself had introduced and supported until the black orator declared his independence. Garrison was a high-minded pacifist and famously despised the United States Constitution as a, quote, covenant with death and an agreement with hell, end quote, because of its inclusion of slavery. Those who followed Garrison, or those who were influenced by him, tended to hold to a religiously oriented form of anti-slavery resistance, largely defined as nonviolent, referred to as moral suasion, because it expressed the anti-slavery argument in jeremiads and diatribes that invoke God's justice based on the Bible, based on moral claims, but without any real political action. Garrison's approach, this moral suasion, in many respects foreshadowed the coming of Martin Luther King Jr. a century later, who also employed nonviolence as a framework philosophy of the civil rights movement. As a side note, it's interesting that King drew inspiration from the Hindu Mohandas Gandhi in advocating his form of nonviolent resistance, given that there was historical precedent for nonviolent protest already embedded in the struggle for racial justice in the United States in terms of Garrison's legacy. But this seems to reflect the fact that although King was not apparently as compelled by the political liberation of colonized nations in Africa and Asia as was Malcolm X, for instance, the zeitgeist of the 20th century suggested that black leaders look internationally at what Malcolm would call the dark world, rather than look to the more provincial history of abolition in the United States. But if Garrison's anti-racist influence was foreshortened in the 20th century, it had already been significantly reduced in the 19th century as a result of the rise of political abolitionism and John Brown's raid on Harper's Ferry especially, which rendered John Brown, and not William Lloyd Garrison, as the most famous abolition hero for the rest of the 19th century and well into the 20th century. It would not be surprising, then, that the children and even grandchildren of William Lloyd Garrison might be a little jealous, if not resentful, toward John Brown. So, as Brown would say, stick a pin in that thought, and we'll come back to it again. Oswald Garrison Villard was the son of William Lloyd Garrison's daughter, Helen Frances Garrison, who was known as Fanny. Fanny Garrison married the German-born Ferdinand Heinrich Hilgard, who had immigrated to the United States in 1853 and took the professional name of Henry Villard. Hilgard, now named Villard, became a successful journalist, first working in German language newspapers, but eventually the New York Daily Tribune. He covered the Lincoln-Douglas debates in 1858, and side note, he didn't think much of Lincoln and thought he was far less qualified for the presidency than was William H. Seward, whom he supported in the 1860 election. But Villard was a strong anti-slavery man and went on to do notable field correspondence during the Civil War. He also covered notable developments like the Pike's Peak Gold Rush and the Franco-Prussian War. In the later years, Villard became a successful railroad promoter, financier, and president of the General Electric Company, which he had financed on behalf of Thomas Edison in 1889. His success in railroad entrepreneurship also allowed him to acquire controlling influence in two New York-based publications, the New York Evening Post and The Nation. Needless to say, his son Oswald Garrison Villard inherited a great deal of privilege that would serve him quite well, even in terms of writing about John Brown. When the elder Villard died in 1900, Oswald, who was born in 1872, assumed his father's interests, both in General Electric and the newspaper business. Following his wealthy and high-minded father, as he called him, Oswald personified what W.E.B. Du Bois's biographer, David Levering Lewis, calls the 14th and 15th Amendment reformers. Quote, the privileged white people who championed the constitutional rights of black people, but were distinctly unsympathetic to aspirations of social equality. End quote. Inheriting his father's wealth and controlling both the New York Evening Post and The Nation, Villard became the quintessential limousine liberal, raising thousands of dollars for black charities. His uncle, Francis Garrison, thus assured him that he was, quote, the natural successor to the custodianship of the family's abolitionist tradition, end quote. Oswald Garrison Villard was about 7 years old when his famous abolitionist grandfather died in 1879, but if his personal memories of William Lloyd Garrison were limited by childhood recollection, nevertheless, he was ensconced in the Garrison legacy and could not help but inherit the family's pride, as well as any particular resentments they may have felt as protectors of the Garrison legacy. The Garrison resentment toward John Brown was subtle and mixed for understandable reasons. On one hand, Brown had managed to steal Garrison's thunder almost in one fell swoop. Garrison had labored in the moral vineyard in opposing slavery from his 20s and had gone on to become the most famous anti-slavery publisher and spokesman and, as noted, had dealt a death blow to the colonizationist so-called solution. Garrison was a kind of father to the abolition movement, and nobody, including John Brown's family and Brown himself, could have escaped the Garrison influence during the antebellum era. John Brown himself was probably influenced by Garrison more in his 20s and 30s, but my sense is that later in the 1830s and certainly the 1840s, he had begun to question the notion of moral suasion. I find no evidence, in fact, that John Brown drew any direct inspiration or model from Garrison as he matured. Part of this, of course, is because Brown was fiercely independent and wanted to find his own way and follow his own counsel. For better and for worse, this was always true of John Brown, which is why Boyd Stutler, who knew Brown's character better than anyone in the 20th century, referred to him as a lone wolf. But I also believe that John Brown had growing reservations about moral suasion and nonviolence. As a Calvinist, Brown believed humans are deeply sinful and stubborn and hard-hearted in our sinfulness, and that absent the intervention of divine grace, bad people don't stop being bad. Agree or not, this was what John Brown believed, and this was essential to the Reformation tradition. And this reflects also what is known as the law-grace paradigm. Calvinists preach the law, that is the law of Moses, to show sinners that they are sinful and under condemnation and cannot self-liberate. But then they preach God's love and grace to show that Christ had come to pay the price for their sin and that they could be transformed by the regeneration of their hearts by His grace. The problem for humanity is that until or unless that happens, that is, God intervenes, the pervasive nature of sin drives humans toward what is wrong, not toward what is right. This is an idea that goes back to St. Augustine and which was relayed by Martin Luther and then John Calvin and John Owen and the British reformers until it finally came down to our John Brown. Now, the long and the short of this is that such a scenario requires civil law and authority to keep sinful man in line at a minimum in this life. The magisterial reformers of the Reformation saw a collaborative nature between civil law and spiritual authority, because civil law dealt with the implications of lawbreaking and sinfulness in society, while the church was to preach the gospel of grace for the souls of men and women. But what happens when the civil law itself becomes corrupted and unjust? Now, many patriot founders of the United States had made this argument in justifying rebellion against England. God's command to obey the king has limits, they argued, after all, and if a king is corrupt, then that king may be disobeyed. John Brown was not a critic of the founders, although he thought they had compromised with slavery in the founding of the nation. He believed the general course of their action was redeemable. Still, since, as he put it, a strange change had taken place since 1776, meaning the lustful grip of slavery had overtaken the nation. John Brown came to believe that some forceful resistance was due to slavery and was entirely consistent with his understanding of the Bible and the Christian faith. And this is very much different from William Lloyd Garrison's notion, which tended to separate the church and spirituality from the state and essentially had no real social political strategy except for crying out against injustice. The idea that force might be ethically justifiable in opposing injustice was antithetical to Garrison's absolute pacifism and his so-called moral suasion outlook. Now, some have simplistically defined the contrast between John Brown and William Lloyd Garrison by describing Brown as a, quote, Old Testament Christian and Garrison as a, quote, New Testament Christian. Now, as a biographer and as one who teaches theology, I beg to differ. The distinction between Old and New Testament gods, that is, Old Testament God is austere and mean, even bellicose, and the New Testament God is one of love, is really a Gnostic notion. It comes from a place in the history of the church that was never accepted by the church. Certainly, John Brown would probably have rejected the label of Old Testament Christian being placed upon him. Christians, technically, are supposed to be Bible people, and that consists of both the Hebrew and the Christian texts, and classical Christianity does not see, and John Brown would have agreed with me, that there is any distinction between the God of the Hebrews and the so-called Old Testament and the God revealed in the New Testament, particularly in the person and work of Jesus. In fact, as Brown would agree, there's ample reference to God's wrath in the Gospels, and there are many references to God's love and mercy in the Hebrew texts, or Old Testament, as Christians refer to it. So, Brown represented the old Calvinist paradigm of reading law and grace, and the belief that you do not nullify the use of force in a fallen world where wickedness can become an organized threat to human flourishing. Unlike the pacifist William Lloyd Garrison, who would not advocate the use of the sword to liberate anyone, including enslaved Africans, Brown believed in some form of measured force as a necessity, what he sometimes called the big stick about the head of the slaveholder. So, by the later 19th century, I'd suggest there were two sticking points with the Garrison family. One was this issue of ideological pacifism, the interpretation of the Bible and the ethics of Jesus as being pacifist. And the other was personal and familial. John Brown had managed to rock the nation and had gained a place in the nation's memory, while William Lloyd Garrison became a secondary figure in the memory of the nation. By analogy, think of how Martin Luther King Jr. and Malcolm X have become the bookend figures for popular thinking concerning the civil rights era. But in their day, King and Malcolm stood among other leaders, men like Adam Clayton Powell Jr., for instance, who deserves much more recognition and memory in the popular thinking about the civil rights era. For all that Garrison had accomplished, it was John Brown who had got the song. And it was John Brown who was rendered by some as a kind of John the Baptist to Lincoln's Jesus Christ for the nation. To put it another way, even in the worst sense, there's no Good Lord Byrd historical fiction or Showtime series that's ever going to be done about William Lloyd Garrison. The Garrison resentment toward John Brown was first expressed, I believe, in 1890 in an interesting piece called The Preludes of Harper's Ferry, published in the Andover Review, an important publication in that era. The author was none other than Wendell Phillips Garrison, the son of William Lloyd Garrison and the namesake of Garrison's esteemed colleague and anti-slavery orator, Wendell Phillips, one of the men, by the way, who had presided over John Brown's burial in 1859. Wendell Phillips Garrison admired Brown, but his piece in the Andover Review was intended to deflate John Brown just a bit. By reading closely through John Brown's memorandum books of the 1830s, he notes that Brown was in Boston in 1838, and yet he found no record that Brown had made any effort to see his father, William Lloyd Garrison. This, Wendell Garrison wrote, must seem strange to anyone who believes that John Brown took the anti-slavery cause seriously when he was in his 30s. The stroke was a gentle one, but Garrison's son was insinuating that John Brown's anti-slavery devotion was overblown by his biographers, particularly Franklin B. Sanborn, whose Life and Letters of John Brown was still the reigning biography in 1890. To his credit, Wendell Garrison's article reveals that it was he who possessed John Brown's early memoranda books and had given them to the Boston Public Library. And as an aside, if you're interested, you can read those memorandum pages yourself on the Boston Public Library website, as they are now digitized. However, the point here is that the Garrisons must have quietly felt that their great progenitor's legacy had been undercut by Brown's soul marching on, and if there was something to the Garrison legacy, part of it must have been to set the record straight as far as they were concerned. And this is precisely what grandson Oswald Garrison Villard intended to do when he determined to write a biography of John Brown in the early 20th century. So, enter grandson Oswald Garrison Villard, Harvard class of 1893. Still in his early 20s, Villard was already cutting his teeth in journalism by working for his father's newspaper, the New York Evening Post. But shortly after graduation, Villard was hired as teaching assistant to Professor Albert Bushnell Hart and was assigned to give a number of lectures at Harvard. It was perhaps his first lecture that Villard took the theme of John Brown and the anti-slavery movement. In his own autobiography, Fighting Years, Villard briefly discussed the experience of trying to handle a class of rowdy young men who probably had a hard time taking the young assistant professor seriously. Probably in conversation with Boyd Stutler in later years, however, Villard gave more information about the episode of lecturing about John Brown at Harvard. Villard told Stutler how his John Brown lecture was punctuated by cheers and loud comments, and when he mentioned that Brown had fathered 20 children, the class broke into cheers and raucous applause. "What a man," they shouted. Villard wrote that his youthful effort at lecturing on Brown inspired him to pursue further work on the abolitionist, culminating, of course, in his biographical effort of 1910. However, I suspect that Villard's inspiration to write about John Brown did not come to him in such a blithe manner. More likely, Villard felt charged with the responsibility to push deeper than even his uncle Wendell Garrison had done only 3 years before his graduation from Harvard. But rather than write an article, Oswald Villard was determined to write a biography of John Brown, although he was not able to initiate such a significant undertaking until he was personally situated as the editor of the New York Evening Post early in 1907. By then, he was equipped to write the, quote, definitive, end quote, biography of John Brown. And by that time, he was both the editor of the New York Evening Post and president of the Post's publishing company. Determined to write this definitive work, Villard enlisted one of his own feature editors, Catherine Mayo, to do research, collate material, and interview surviving witnesses across the country. With the considerable resources accessible to him, Villard sent Mayo packing, traveling from coast to coast to look for anyone to interview who was still living from John Brown's era. As Boyd Stutler himself concluded, barely has a country been combed so carefully as by Mr. Villard and Miss Mayo. And Mayo, in fact, gave the next 2 years of her life to this project, allowing Villard to amass a stunning amount of primary and secondary materials, not to mention interviews that she made with a number of John Brown's family and associates. It was a kairos moment in John Brown biography. And while I am myself critical of Villard's portrayal of the abolitionist, the materials he compiled and the interviews conducted by Catherine Mayo between 1907 and 1909 may be the most fortuitous development in John Brown work besides the essential collection of Stutler himself. Incidentally, Stutler finally assisted the elderly Villard in the mid-1940s, only a few years before Villard's death, to prepare a revision of that original biography, which was published in 1910. In the preface of his John Brown biography, author Villard proclaimed his work was, quote, free from bias, from the errors in taste and fact of the mere panegyrist, and from the blind prejudice of those who can see in John Brown nothing but a criminal, end quote. He likewise boasted new findings from research and authoritative interviews with many of Brown's family and associates. Besides the extensive research supporting his work, Villard's biography provided an extensive chronology and fact check of previous writings, really making it indispensable for 20th century scholars. To be sure, Villard's biography superseded all previous biographies of Brown, and Villard himself disdained the older biographies of Brown by Franklin Sanborn, 1885, and Richard Hinton, 1893. He was largely correct that both Sanborn and Hinton had prepared worshipful treatments of Brown, although in my opinion, Sanborn's work is nevertheless far more reliable and valuable as a resource, while Hinton's writing is unreliable and even untrustworthy at points. Villard thus considered their works partisan and announced that his intention was to test Brown fairly, quote, by accepted ethical standards, end quote, and to, quote, pass a deliberate and accurate historical judgment upon him, end quote. However, in reality, Villard's interpretation of Brown was likewise partisan and ideological, and certainly quite apropos of his conscious role as, quote, the natural successor to the custodianship of the Garrison legacy. Like his grandfather and uncle before him, Villard's work smacked of ambivalence toward John Brown. On one hand, uplifting his valor and sincerity as an opponent of slavery, and on the other, diminishing him for his use of violence in Kansas and at Harper's Ferry. In style, Garrison's manuscript proved tedious and flat, as Albert Fried put it, quote, stitched together with lengthy quotations and full to the brim with moralizing, end quote. Those who knew John Brown resented Villard's portrayal, which made of him a restless soul. Certainly, none were pleased with his conclusions about the 1856 killings of the pro-slavery collaborators on Pottawatomie Creek in Kansas, which Villard claimed were nothing more than inexcusable murder, the moral nadir of a man who was otherwise good. While Villard's book received high praise from editors and reviewers, John Brown's surviving children were deeply offended by it. Salmon Brown, one of the Pottawatomie killers, by then quite elderly, read Villard's new biography and wrote with disgust to Villard, quote, your attempt to pose as a historian with your godforsaken ideas of resistance to tyrants will not go down with the old revolutionary stock in the best government in the world, nor with our old soldiers that put down the slaveholders' rebellion, end quote. Salmon insinuated further that Villard's pacifist grandfather, William Lloyd Garrison, and his followers had evaded danger, quote, under cover of their non-resistant views, only to let others defend their rights with their blood and treasure. Hurt and offended, John Brown's son concluded, I'm saying this to a live man, not about an old man that has been dead over 50 years, end quote. In private correspondence, Villard gloated that his book would upset the John Brown set, especially Franklin B. Sanborn, who had single-handedly upheld Brown's legacy from the post-Civil War years and into the first decade of the 20th century. Privately, too, Villard disliked Sanborn as a man and would later tell Stutler, in a letter, that he thought the New England teacher and writer was both a coward and a blowhard. As far as the Pottawatomie killings were concerned, Villard was particularly intent on overturning Sanborn's defense of Brown. Quote, Sanborn and the others who have made of John Brown a demigod will not like my book, he wrote. The more I study Pottawatomie, the less excuse I find for it, end quote. Yet it was especially here that Villard was anything but unbiased. And in retrospect, it seems to me he was carrying a brief for his grandfather's legacy as well as his own passionate, perhaps fanatical zeal for pacifism. Again, Villard's treatment of Brown, particularly his condemnation of Brown's actions at Pottawatomie, expressed two motivations, an absolute commitment to pacifism and a determination to offset Brown's legacy in the name of his grandfather Garrison's half-remembered role as the leader of the anti-slavery movement. In his biography, Villard thus contended that John Brown had no justification for that violent assault on his pro-slavery neighbors in Kansas, resulting in the deaths of five enemies. To Villard, Brown was an idealistic murderer motivated by an unselfish ambition to free the enslaved. Personally, Villard was playing the legacy game. Writing to William Connolly, one of Brown's Kansas admirers, for instance, Villard showed his real motivation. You see, he wrote almost gleefully, my grandfather never thought it necessary for the sake of freedom, to take men from their homes in the dead of night and dispatch them in cold blood. End quote. Of course, despite his professional biographical writing and the marshaling of evidence and testimony in an unprecedented manner, Villard nevertheless read the facts in a self-serving way, determined that John Brown could have only had a, quote, general reason or previous conviction, end quote, as a basis for killing five men on the Pottawatomie Creek. He lightly dismissed evidence, some of which his own assistant had gathered for the first time, that the Browns were in real danger and had no recourse to protection from the law. He took as confirmation his own presumptions and drew the conclusion that it apparently held from the onset. Annie Brown Adams, another of John Brown's aged children, could not have been taken by surprise either. 2 years before Villard's book was even released, they had already debated in correspondence regarding the issue of her father's use of force. Quote, "You look at this matter from a Garrisonian point of view," Annie wrote, "while I look at it from John Brown's and his men's point of view." And she continues, "Moral suasion and non-resistance are excellent doctrines to preach in times of peace, but often in troublous times, someone has to fight for peace and fight hard, too, and then endure the remarks that are made by the carpet knights and quill drivers who were not in the fray but stayed peacefully at home enjoying the after-benefits derived from others' exertions. I am not trying to apologize for my father or his friends," Annie concludes, "but to show you what, from their point of view, led on to Pottawatomie." End quote. Using the biography, Villard had chastened John Brown in order to retrieve his grandfather's pacifist legacy from the shadows of history. He had also made Brown a kind of victim to his heedless pacifism. In the words of Stefan Thernstrom, as the prophet of the great revolt against militarism in America, Villard was so fanatical about pacifism that he would probably have consented to let Hitler go unchecked. Even before the bombing of Pearl Harbor, Villard privately conceded that he had become a has-been. Perhaps it was a kind of historical karma, not only because he had used his biography as friendly fire to the harm of John Brown's legacy, not to mention that he equipped future writers who hated John Brown to use his thesis against Brown in an even worse manner. But the backstory to Villard's biography is also about how he used his family heritage and resources to the disadvantage of someone else. And that someone else was the African-American scholar and writer William Edward Burghardt Du Bois. And in doing so, reveals the limits of his white liberalism. It should be recalled that if Villard published his biography of Brown in 1910, he was beaten to the shelves by W.B. Du Bois, who had published his own biography of John Brown the year before, 1909. Du Bois was then a professor at Atlanta University, and he produced his John Brown amidst a demanding schedule of teaching, lecturing, editing, and activism, but completed it in 1908 when Catherine Mayo was still gathering source material for Villard. To be sure, Du Bois's John Brown, which I have discussed previously in my podcast, had significant flaws and deficiencies, particularly because Du Bois had relied on older published biographies and sources that had not yet been reevaluated and corrected. As I've stated elsewhere, Du Bois's work is best appreciated for its lyrical prose and the spirit of its portrayal of John Brown. It's not a good scholarly source. Yet in fairness to Du Bois, he had not intended to produce the kind of biography that Villard was preparing. Note that he had wanted, at first, to write a biography of Frederick Douglass, and when that was denied him, he chose to write about Nat Turner, and yet again his intentions were undermined by editorial authority. So it was only his third choice to write about John Brown, and yet Du Bois approached the subject with great passion and virtue that still distinguishes it as a work in the 21st century. As Du Bois's biographer David Levering Lewis has observed, John Brown was a milestone revealing Du Bois's increasing willingness to commingle advocacy with scholarship, to envelop history and social science in judgment and prophecy, end quote. However, at the time of its publication, Villard did not make such gracious distinctions in reviewing Du Bois's John Brown. In fact, Villard went quite out of his way to bash the book. Despite its great advances in research, Villard's book was essentially an elitist production and interpretation, and so Villard castigated Du Bois for an uncritical use of older sources, although most of Villard's research was done by his paid assistant, Catherine Mayo. My own sense is that Mayo was actually a better writer than Villard, and probably understood John Brown's legacy better than Villard too, and Villard himself could not make full use of her gatherings. Those are his words. Indeed, anyone who has made an extensive survey of Villard's papers, as I have, would agree that Villard fell far short in using the wealth of primary historical material provided by his assistant. And it's interesting that when Mayo later acquired a name for herself as an author, she did nothing to disclaim rumors that she had ghostwritten Villard's John Brown. She didn't, of course, and you can inspect Villard's own handwritten manuscript at Columbia University if you wish to do so. Villard himself was annoyed by that rumor, but he made no public comment about it either. Yet he could scarcely have done better than Du Bois without the luxury of being able to afford paying someone to do his research for him. As owner of both The Nation and the New York Evening Post, Villard took full advantage of his position as a publisher to prepare a harsh, unsigned review of Du Bois' John Brown for both of his newspapers. When Du Bois wrote in protest, Villard showed no grace, even leaving the task of responding to Du Bois to The Nation's editor, Paul Moore, who then condescendingly lectured Du Bois about writing history and the proper use of sources. Happily, Du Bois did not relent. He countered in response that since Villard, being the author of a new book on John Brown, had crept, quote, behind anonymity, end quote, to give his book an unfair drubbing, it would not look good for his paper to refuse him a chance to respond in print. Nevertheless, despite his repeated appeals to have a fair hearing in the press, Du Bois was refused the opportunity to publish a response. Beyond this unsatisfying correspondence, then, nothing more came of the issue, and soon Villard's book was published in 1910, completely overshadowing Du Bois's slighted biography. To Du Bois's credit, he went on to work cooperatively with Villard afterward in civil rights efforts. But as David Levering Lewis concluded, quote, rancor would always exist between them just below the surface, end quote. More revealing, Du Bois later commented that to a white philanthropist like Villard, a Negro was quite naturally expected to be humble and thankful, or certainly not assertive or aggressive, end quote. If Villard expected black scholarly colleagues to be passive, he also opposed the notion of African Americans defending themselves in the face of racist violence. In a speech he made on John Brown's birthday in 1925, Villard actually stood near John Brown's grave and praised him with the same sort of ambivalence that he applied to his biography over a decade before. Quote, however one feels about John Brown, whether one believes in his doctrine of violence or not, Villard lectured, there's one thing about him which we can all join in admiring, and that is his devotion to his cause, end quote. Though lamenting the deprivation of black people's constitutional rights, he continued, again, I do not uphold his methods of force, being utterly opposed to the use of arms for any purpose, and believing human life inviolable. I counsel only peaceful methods. I do not even believe that colored people, when attacked by any mobs, should use the pistol and the rifle. That way, destruction lies. And if it were futile for John Brown, it is 1,000 times more futile today, but I do urge wholeheartedly that the colored people of America make of John Brown the moral crusader their inspiration and their model, and that they devote themselves without stint and without question to the cause of freedom, which was but half won when Lee surrendered and emancipation became a reality, end quote. So here was Villard, virtually standing on top of John Brown's body, praising him as a moral crusader and model for African Americans, while at the same time prophesying destruction and futility over his work or any work of its kind, that is, self-defense. Whatever African Americans thought of such counsel, it was clear that Villard was asking them to suffer violence and oppression rather than resist by force, a notion that would have made John Brown turn over in his grave. Despite Villard's negative interpretation of John Brown as an idealistic murderer, He was often considered John Brown's last and best friend in 20th century biography. As mentioned, some writers following him were outrightly antagonistic, either out of Southern sympathy or because of political prejudice. Albert Freed observes that following Villard's era, the major works on Brown were published between 1912 and 1942, a period when racism and xenophobia blossomed, the virtual heyday of legalized segregation. American historians and writers from this period tended to revisit the Civil War with a grudge against the Republican and anti-slavery North, while styling the South with sympathy and romance. The worst writings that came forth in this period had no value except to those who hated John Brown with a blind prejudice, while others fused political vendetta with Villard's valuable research. By mid-20th century, many white historians looked back at the era of slavery allegedly without emotion and bias, and concluded that it was extremists on both sides of the issue who brought ruin upon the nation. Thus, the abolitionists of the North and the militant pro-slavery forces of the South were both to blame. In 1951, Allen Nevins suggested that the Civil War might even have been avoided except for, quote, passionate unreason among large sections of the population, end quote. John Brown's raid was thus a crazy action as far as Nevins was concerned, thoroughly malign in its effect on opinion, North and South, end quote. As to Villard himself, he might have shown more grace to both John Brown and to his own contemporary W.E.B. Du Bois. Today, it is Du Bois who is remembered, quoted, and even celebrated. Today, Du Bois's flawed John Brown biography has been reprinted and read by myriads and continues to be a favorite of the John Brown bookshelf. Only the scholars are reading Villard's book, and Villard himself has been held up to the light of history by scholars who have recognized his paternalism and idealism. By way of what goes around comes around, as early as 1960, only 11 years after Villard's death, Stefan Thernstrom passed historical judgment on him, writing that, quote, his idealism was naive, his morality self-righteous, and sometimes hypocritical. His passion for absolutes made him often intolerant, and his grasp of politics and history was never profound and rarely penetrating. Villard was a political journalist, rather simple, shrill, shallow, and his personality thin and dry. End quote. Ouch. Well, by way of epilogue, I would still say that I have a well-worn copy of Villard's John Brown, a 1929 printing that was published without making any changes to the 1910 first edition. In the 1940s, as I mentioned, Villard quietly sought the help of Boyd Stutler to correct a good number of errors in his biography, preparing for a final publication and the first and only revision of Villard's biography in 1943. My first year as a John Brown researcher was spent in Villard's papers at Columbia University, which he had sold to Columbia when he was old and was forced to downsize his apartment in Manhattan. I'm convinced that Villard would have needed another volume to make the best use of all the research that Catherine Mayo provided him. Still, I actually reached for Villard's biography as a reference work rather than Stephen Oates's 1970 biography, which was praised as being more objective and thoroughly researched. Early in my writing on John Brown, perhaps I was harsh and polemical toward Mr. Villard in a manner that I would not be today, perhaps because I'm getting older myself and more reflective, but also because for all of his bias and self-interest, Villard did not really hate John Brown or hold him in contempt in the way a segment of authors and historians continue to demonstrate. And as I've said too, I'm grateful that Villard's work was done, if only because it was Villard who made the monumental research of Catherine Mayo possible, a historical gain that took place in the nick of time before a whole generation of eyewitnesses passed away beyond the veil and beyond our historical inquiry. As John Brown would put it, so we go. From New York City, this has been Louis A. DiCaro Jr., and this was John Brown Today.